So welcome to today's sutta class, where we read through some of the original teachings of the Buddha, or ascribed to the Buddha. And some time ago, somebody went through all the ones we've talked about before, so I have a list of those suttas I haven't spoken about before. And there's usually a reason why you don't speak about the more popular suttas, because sometimes they're a little bit quirky. And this is one of the quirky ones today. But nevertheless, I'm sure you're going to have some fun with this. And remember, these teachings of the Buddha, this is not like some holy Bible or text which you have to believe at all costs. Each one of these little teachings over here has some important things to say, and there's also some things which you may find a bit incredible, which means that those things which you, like any buffet, where you don't feel it's appropriate, then we can just put it aside and just take on those little pieces of information where we are interested. And there was, in this particular story here, there's some weird stuff about this person in the Buddhist cosmology called Mara. It has only got some similarities with the idea of a Christian devil. And maybe actually by understanding this person of Mara, we can get some idea of that, the evolution of those theistic concepts. Because this guy Mara was not so much an evil person as just a person who was into a power trip. And as such, born as a heavenly being, still nevertheless, because of the sense of ego, power and control, basically keeps on losing it. And also in this story, in this sutta, we have one of my favorite stories, which I've often mentioned during retreat times, about what happens when you get into deep meditation. And afterwards, we do have some stories about what to do, and this is the most important part of the sutta for us, is what to do when people praise you and what to do when people abuse you. So these are the nice part of the sutta, which gives you some teachings to take home with you. So here we go, the rebuke to Mara, the Mara Tajaniya Sutta. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. So this is the 50th sutta in the section Majjhima Nikaya, the rebuke to Mara. Thus have I heard, on one occasion the Venerable Mahamoggallana, this is one of the chief disciples, was living in the Bagga country at Sungsumaragira, which is actually a crocodile mountain, in the Besakala Grove, the deer park. Now on that occasion the Venerable Mahamoggallana was walking up and down in the open, doing his walking meditation. And on that occasion, Mara, the evil one, went in to the Venerable Mahamoggallana's belly and entered his bowels. Then the Venerable Mahamoggallana considered thus, why is my belly so heavy? One would think it is full of beans. And I think many of you may be able to relate to such experiences if you've eaten too many baked beans or other beans. Remember, the beans were one of the staples of the diet in those days. One would think it is full of beans. Thus he left the walk and went into his dwelling, where he sat down on a seat made ready. When he had sat down, he gave thorough attention to himself. And he saw, because this was Mahamoggallana, had great deep meditation and psychic powers, he saw that Mara, the evil one, had gone into his belly and entered his bowels. So, as I mentioned, I think, in the advertisement to this on a Friday night, if you do have any indigestion, especially in the lower part of your body, please go into meditation and scan your body and see if Mara has gone into your bowels. So he saw that Mara, the evil one, had gone into his belly and entered his bowels. When he saw this, he said, come out, evil one, come out, evil one. do not harass the Tathagata, that's the Buddha, do not harass the Buddha's disciple, or it will lead to your harm and suffering for a long time. Then Mao, the evil one, thought, this recluse does not know me. He does not see me when he says that. Even his teacher would not know me so soon. So how could his disciple know me? Then the Venerable Mahamoggallana said, even thus I know you, evil one. Don't think he does not know me. You are Mara, evil one. You are thinking thus, evil one. This recluse does not know me. He does not see me when he says that. Even his teacher would not know me so soon. How can this disciple know me? Then Mara, the evil one, thought, the recluse knew me. He saw me when he said that. Whereupon he came up from the Venerable Moggallana's mouth and stood against the door bar. That's an interesting little thing. Maybe he burped and then gave the opportunity for him to come out. Now, of course, this Mara fellow, this is one occasion when it is a person, sometimes that we understand this as a not as a person, but as a symbol of being tempted or being controlled. And sometimes it's used in a symbolic fashion, but in this case it's obviously as a real person, a real being. And of course, those of you who have more knowledge about the Buddhist cosmology and all the beings who live in the different realms, the Mara is supposed to be the head of the Paranimitta Vasavati realm, basically the realm of those who wield power over others. In other words, this is a being who's in a position of control. And just as that famous British philosopher Lord Acton said, power corrupts, absolute power corrupts absolutely. And anyone, even if you are a heavenly being who's put in a position with so much authority and power, it will have a corrupting influence on you. And one of the reasons that Mara was trying to play around with the Buddha's disciples was because they were becoming out of his power, out of his reach. In other words, the Mara could not control these people, the enlightened monks and nuns. And in another sutta, this is just embellishing this, in another sutta, I think it's called the bait, there the Buddha was saying, there are places where Mara cannot go, where Mara's eye cannot reach. And those are the places called, surprise, surprise, the jhanas. Those are the places which Mara cannot see. And the reason behind that, as I've often pointed out, that these are the states of letting go, where control is abandoned, where all sort of desire, control, manipulation is left behind a long time before. And so when you're not actually in that world of controlling, this controller-in-chief just can't get a handle on you. But every time you have a will, a choice, a want, a craving, then that, as they say, gives Mara its opportunity to control your creating. When you don't create, then Mara's lost you. Can't find you. And that was one of the reasons why that Mara was always trying to discover what these monks or what the Buddha was up to and trying to sort of make them be under his control. Now, it's also to be known in Buddhism that all of these beings in all these different states, you know, from the highest god to the lowest person, every being actually goes through these states, as you were, that we can get reincarnated into any of these states. And this is where Mahamoggallana, with his very deep meditation, remembering past lives, was recalling an occasion when he was a Mara, then he was in that position in the time of a previous Buddha. So this is what's happening now, that Mahamoggallana says, it happened once, evil one. No, I see you there too. Then Venerable Mahamoggallana saw him standing there and said, I see you there too, evil one. Do not think he does not see me. You are standing against the door bar, evil one. It happened once, evil one, that I was a Mara named Dusi, and I had a sister named Kali, and you were her son, so you were my nephew. Now, so they really get into these relations. Now, on that occasion, the Blessed One, the Buddha, Kakusanda, accomplished and fully enlightened, had appeared in the world. The Blessed One, Kakusanda, accomplished and fully enlightened, had an auspicious pair of chief disciples, named Vidura and Sanjiva. So each, according to the tradition, every Buddha who appears in this world has two chief disciples. And, just for interest, a future Buddha is supposed to be Maitreya. Another future Buddha is supposed to be Amitabha. Amitabha is supposed to be a future Buddha, a long time in the future. And who knows the names of the future Buddha Amitabha's two chief disciples? Just like we've got Sariputra Moggallana for our Buddha, and here we've got Vidura and Sanjiva for Kakusanda, who was a long time ago. In a future Amitabha Buddha, he's supposed to have two chief disciples, and they are, one of them is called Vayama, like Ajahn Vayama, but the other one was called Avalokitesvara. In other words, Kuan Yin. This is the origin of Kuan Yin. So Avalokitesvara was originally, in the history of Buddhism, was supposed to be one of the chief disciples of a future Buddha. And now, Avalokitesvara means literally one who looks down on others. That's what it really means. In other words, a compassionate being. Vayama means effort. And of those two chief disciples, the one regarding effort didn't really catch on to people's imagination. People are generally lazy, so they weren't too interested in effort. But compassion and kindness, they were certainly interested in that. So over the history of Buddhism, these two started as chief disciples. Vayama just got lost by people not being interested in him. But Avalokitesvara, being basically one of the chief disciples of a future Buddha of compassion, that became very well known and famous. And of course, people started making statues of Avalokitesvara, which because he was just a chief disciple and not really a disciple yet, he was a man with a beard. And over the years, when Buddhism went to China, Avalokitesvara, because it was compassion, and people associated the feminine gender with compassion much more than the male gender, they had the first sex change. And Avalokitesvara became known as a woman. And so now, whenever you see any of the statues of Avalokitesvara, Kuan Yin, Kanon, you find that it's a woman. But it started off as one of the chief disciples of a future Buddha, one of the two chief disciples. And now it's something completely different. So it's just like the evolution of ideas, even in Buddhism. It's just I'll throw that in. Yes, Dania? Aha, now that's another interesting thing. He says the Buddha can't predict the future, and indeed, everything about Amitabha and Avalokitesvara, even that only started to arise maybe 500, 600 years after the time of our Buddha. So this was, again, the whole idea of future Buddhas. Even though the Buddha said, well, there's one now, there'd been some before, there'll be some in the future. This wasn't so much a prediction of when, it was just saying, well, it's going to happen, it must happen. But the idea of Amitabha, the Buddha only predicted, and it's only in one short sutra, that there would be Maitreya, would be a Buddha, a long time in the future. But that's the only one he talked about. Never talked about Amitabha. But that came up later on. Okay, anyway. So here we have that it happened once, even one, that I was a Mara named Lucy, and I had a sister named Kali. You were her son, so you were my nephew. On that occasion, the Buddha Kakusanda, accomplished and fully enlightened, had appeared in the world. And the Buddha Kakusanda, accomplished and fully enlightened, had an auspicious pair of chief disciples named Vidura and Sanjiva. Among all the disciples of the Blessed One, Kakusanda, accomplished and fully enlightened, there was none equal to the Venerable Vidura in teaching the Dhamma. That was how the Venerable Vidura came to have the designation of Vidura, which has something to do with wisdom. But the Venerable Sanjiva, so Vidura was the one who had really good at teaching, and Sanjiva was more into meditation. And he mentions, but the Venerable Sanjiva, gone to the forest or to the root of a tree or to an empty hut, entered without difficulty upon the cessation of perception and feeling, which is the deepest of the immaterial attainments. So this is in a very, very deep jhanas. And it happened once, Evil One, that the Venerable Sanjiva had seated himself at the root of a certain tree and entered upon the cessation of perception and feeling. Some cowherds, shepherds, and ploughmen passing by saw the Venerable Sanjiva sitting at the root of a tree, having entered upon the cessation of perception and feeling. And they thought, "It is wonderful, sirs, it is marvelous. There is this recluse sitting here, dead. Let us cremate him." Then the cowherds, shepherds, and ploughmen collected grass, wood, and cow dung, and having piled up against the Venerable Sanjiva's body, they set fire to it and went on their way. Now he's only meditating. But don't worry, it always has a happy ending. "Now, evil one, when the night had ended, the Venerable Sanjiva emerged from that attainment. He shook his robe, and then, it being morning, he dressed and taking his bowl and outer robe, he went into the village for alms. The cowherds, shepherds, and ploughmen passing it saw the Venerable Sanjiva wandering for alms, and they thought, 'It is wonderful, sirs, it is marvelous. This recluse who was sitting there dead has come back to life.'" That was how the Venerable Sanjiva came to have the designation Sanjiva, which means, you know, with life. Now, I've used that story before in some of the retreats, because when people go into these deep meditations, or they're about to, and they think, "Oh, it's going to be very dangerous. What happens if something happens to me?" I mentioned that particular story. Don't worry. Even if people think you're dead and they take you to Karakata to be cremated, it doesn't matter. When they open up the oven afterwards, you just shake off your robe or your jacket, if you're wearing a jacket, and give them a big fright. Because apparently in these deep meditations you're totally invulnerable and you don't get burnt. Now, in my own experience as a monk, there was one Indonesian monk a long time ago, and this guy, you know, did have those psychic powers. I don't know what's happened to him, so I don't mind talking about this. It was somebody I knew, and you knew who he was. I wouldn't mention it, but because he sort of disappeared, I don't mind telling you this, that he told me personally that he had once got into the deep jungles of Java and sat meditation, and he got into a very, very deep state of meditation. He was meditating literally for quite a few days. And when he came out afterwards, he noticed that where he'd been sitting, there was the signs of a flood. You could actually see the water marks on the top of the trees and sort of lots of debris around. And he checked with the villagers, and yes, there had been a very heavy storm, and that particular place had flooded. And he'd been immersed underwater, maybe a meter or two of water, for several days. But he was just sitting there meditating, and he knew nothing about it, and he was perfectly okay. Now, I know that monk, so it's not an exaggeration. There he was, in deep meditation, totally underwater for days. So, if you ever happen to be in Java or Bali or on the coast of Thailand and there's a tsunami, just get into deep meditation quickly and you'll be all right. Okay, some questions on this. Go on. Yes, Aisley. Oh yeah, there's also one person who comes here who went into a deep meditation, was taken to St. Charles Gardner Hospital. And he wasn't breathing. He had no sort of brain activity. The ECG and EEG registered flat lines. And he came out. He was just meditating, that's all. Okay, so remember that in order to answer that question about the energy of the mind and these deep meditations, it needs to be understood that the framework of Buddhism is not sort of the material world first and the mind is just, you know, some addition to this material world. As far as Buddhism is concerned, the mind is the forerunner, is the main thing, and this material world is an addition to the mental world. So instead of the framework of the mind existing somewhere in material time and space, we say that time and space exists within the mind. So if you look at it in that particular way, you get a much better understanding for an answer to that question. It's not the mind is in this space. Space is in the mind. Okay, no, it's as if that the mind can embrace this body and can work on it, control it, can use this body to experiment, to live, to play in this world. But when this body is of no use, the mind discards it. Now, of course, I haven't seen this, but people have been telling me about a movie, Avatar. And in Avatar, that somehow this being, it's supposed to be an American soldier or something, that he takes control of this body in this different realm. If I got that right, if those people have seen Avatar? So someone's nodding their head, so it must be reasonably right. So in this human realm, this guy is taking control of this body in this alien planet. So imagine that man is like the mind, and this body in this alien planet is your body right now. So your mind is pulling the strings of your body. But the body is just, you know, what the mind makes use of for the time being. Yes? So, yeah, well, yeah, okay. Well, I'll probably sort of discard that because it's really off the sutta here. So we've got to keep on the sutta, otherwise we'll go into all sorts of interesting but sort of not really relevant discussions. So anyway, that's what happens when you go into deep meditation. So don't worry about anything. If they bury you, you just knock on the coffin. And sort of they'll hear you up above. Okay. Okay, so that's the end of paragraph 11. Then, evil one, Maradusi considered us. There are these virtuous monks of good character, but I do not know their coming or their going. In other words, so when they go to deep meditation, just doesn't know where they go to, because that's where will disappears, and Mara just can't find them when there's no will. There are these various monks of good character. I do not know their coming or their going. Let me now take possession of the householders, telling them, come now, abuse, revile, scold, and harass the virtuous monks of good character. Then perhaps, when they are abused, reviled, scolded, and harassed by you, some change will come about in their minds, whereby the Maradusi may find an opportunity. Just when they really get upset about being abused, when they try and do a little bit of controlling, then he can grab them. Then, evil one, the Maradusi took possession of those Brahmin householders, telling them, come now, abuse, revile, scold, and harass the virtuous monks of good character. Then perhaps when they are abused, reviled, scolded, and harassed by you, some change will come about in their minds, whereby the Maradusi might find an opportunity. Then when the Maradusi had taken possession of the Brahmin householders, they abused, reviled, scolded, and harassed the virtuous monks of good character thus. These bald-pated recluses, you know, you baldies, these swarthy, menial offspring of the kinsman's feet. Now, that was supposed to be pretty sort of coarse in the time of the Buddha. Obviously, in Australia in 2010, they would use much more colourful speech. And, of course, in my time as a monk, I have been abused as a lazy, good-for-nothing bludger, wearing girls' clothes, why didn't I get a proper job? Although, I must admit that the worst abuse, I was with Ajahn Sumedho once, when he was... We were in the northern city of Darlington, in that's just Yorkshire. And this man came, we were going for a walk in the early morning, and this man, a gentleman in his business suit, sort of maybe about in his mid-50s, came up to Ajahn Sumedha and looked him up and down with disgust and said the simple words to him, "You're old enough to know better." Because in those days, I mean, like being a monk was like, you know, the sort of thing you do in your 20s, you know, just go to India and become a guru and then you get that out of your system, and being a bit of a hippie. And there was a wonderful little bit of Vivani. "You're old enough to know better." But anyway, it's very funny, so I always remember that one. But anyway, so the Mahāyāna got these people to try and abuse the monks. These bald-pated men, Ospreys, kinsmen, flee. And they claim, "We are meditators, we are meditators." And with shoulders drooping, head down and all limp, they meditate, premeditate, out-meditate and mismeditate. Just as an owl on a branch waiting for a mouse meditates, premeditates, out-meditates and mismeditates. Or just as a jackal on a riverbank waiting for fish meditates, premeditates, out-meditates and mismeditates. Or just as a cat by a doorpost or a dustbin or a drain waiting for a mouse meditates, premeditates, out-meditates and mismeditates. Or just like a stupid donkey, unladen, standing by a doorpost or a dustbin or a drain, meditates, premeditates, out-meditates and mismeditates. So too these ball-plated recluse, these swarthy, menial offspring of kinsmen's feet, claim we are meditators, we are meditators. And with shoulders drooping, heads down, and all limp, they meditate, premeditate, out-meditate, and mismeditate. Now, of course, there's some interesting stuff in that. First of all, it shows that from the early time that the monks were meditators. That was what we were about. Meditation, meditation, meditation. Weren't into being priests, you know, who were giving chanting and splashing holy water and giving protections and doing all these ceremonies. Shows in that time the monks were known as meditators. And it also shows that in that time there would have been some monks who meditated. But their heads right down. Their heads right down, all limp, just like you do sometimes. It's par for the course, okay? 2,500 years ago that happened. So it happens these days. And the idea of people actually, I'm not understanding what meditation is. You know, you've just been like a stupid cat waiting for a mouse. Yeah, they can sit still. Donkeys, you know, just waiting for the next burden. Yeah, they can stand still. And the owls, you know, on the tree, they sat still, but they're not in line. What a stupid thing to do, just blanking out. So that's actually what they were doing. It was showing that even in those days, people who had no understanding at all about meditation would put it down. And Bhikkhu Bodhi did an excellent job here because they were using a play on words when they say they meditate, premeditate, out-meditate, and mismeditate. It was actually a similar play on words. They're using some of the other words with meditation, jhana, at the beginning, and just using other words which were used in those days, which meant, you know, just it wasn't really meditation, they were just stupid, blanking out or whatever. So, you know, it gives an example that even in those days, people would abuse you for meditating, just blanking out. Why do you do something more useful instead of just sitting around doing nothing? So... Now, evil one, this is almost to the end of paragraph 13. Now, evil one, on that occasion, most of those human beings, when they died, reappeared on the dissolution of the body after death in a state of deprivation, an unhappy destination in perdition, even in hell, because of their bad speech. And as Ajahn Brahmani used to point out, he said, well, this is a bit unfair, because it wasn't the lay people's fault, and Mahāyāna put them up to it. But he only says most of them, because obviously some people would not see that and they would not allow Mahāyāna to sort of take control of them. But nevertheless, saying bad things about meditation, about good monks and nuns, is bad karma. But anyway, so they were being abused, so what should you do when you're being abused? Then the Blessed One, Kakusanda, accomplished and fully enlightened, addressed the monks thus. Monks, the Maradusi has taken possession of the Brahmin householders, telling them, come now, abuse, revile, scold and harass the virtuous monks of good character. Then perhaps when they are abused, reviled, scolded and harassed by you, some change will come about in their mind. Usually meaning they get angry. whereby the Mahavadhusi may find an opportunity to control those monks. So the Buddha's advice is, come monks, abide pervading one quarter with a mind imbued with loving kindness. Likewise the second, likewise the third, likewise the fourth. That means the four directions. So above, so below, around and everywhere, and to all as to yourselves. Abide pervading the all-encompassing world with a mind imbued with loving kindness, abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility and without ill will. Abide pervading one quarter, all four quarters above and below, everywhere, to all as to yourself, a mind imbued with compassion. All the quarters above, below, all around, to others as to yourself, a mind imbued with appreciative joy. All the quarters above, below, all around, as to others, to yourself, with a mind imbued with equanimity. Abundant, exhausted, immeasurable, without hostility, without ill will. So that's the classic advice when people abuse you. Now I'm going to point out some interesting factors of that advice. You don't go spreading loving kindness straight away to the person who abused you, which is people's big mistake. So someone tells you off, and say, a monk, or you think, I should spread loving kindness towards them. No. Dear mother-in-law, may you be happy and well. Dear mother-in-law, you can't do it because that's a bloody mother-in-law. So you don't do it that way, because if you start off with that person who's upset you, you find it's impossible. You're not being real because you're upset to them. So instead, you develop loving kindness to all beings, first of all, or to the easy stuff, as I say. No, not while they're right in front of you. Love the tiger at a distance, not while they're in front of you. So may all beings be happy and well. In the first quarter, the second quarter, third, up and down, all over, everyone, and to yourself as well. And then when you've developed this beautiful loving kindness towards everybody, then whenever you see that person, you've got this so much love and kindness in you from the very beginning, or you just can't help it, because you've developed the loving kindness just generally, first of all, and then you apply it to the enemy. And that way, and as to others, as to yourself, you must always include yourself. Because if you don't include yourself, if that person's is not focused on, again, it does not work. So when you are abused by someone, you don't just spread loving kindness to them and sit down. Go back to your room, loving kindness to the whole world, compassion, sympathetic joy, equanimity to the whole world and to yourself. And then when you start thinking of them, oh, they're not that bad. So you don't get angry at them. So that was the Buddha's advice, how to deal with sort of abuse and being reviled. Any comments about that? Okay. So, evil one, when those bhikkhus had thus been advised and instructed by the Buddha Kakusanda, accomplished and fully enlightened, then gone to the forest or to the root of a tree or to an empty hut, they abided pervading one quarter with a mind imbued with loving kindness, with compassion, with appreciative joy, with a mind imbued with equanimity, without hostility and without ill will. Then evil one, the Mahavadhusi considered thus, though I do as I'm doing, still I do not know the coming or the going of those virtuous monks of good character. Still I can't so upset them. Let me now take possession of the Brahmin householders, telling them, come now, honour, respect, revere and venerate the virtuous monks of good character. And perhaps when you are honoured, respected, revered and venerated by you, some change will come about in their minds, whereby the Mahavadhusi may find an opportunity. So when abuse doesn't work, you know, we try praise. Then evil one, the Mahavadhusi took possession of those Brahmin householders, telling them, come now, honour, respect, revere and venerate the virtuous monks of good character. Then perhaps when they are honoured, respected, revered and venerated by you, some change will come about in their minds, whereby the Mahavadhusi may find an opportunity. Then when the Mahavadhusi had taken possession of the Brahmin householders, they honoured, respected, revered and venerated the virtuous monks of good character. Now, evil one, on that occasion, most of those human beings, when they died, reappeared on the dissolution of the body after death in a happy destination, even the heavenly world. Then, evil one, the blessed one Kakusanda, accomplished and fully enlightened, addressed amongst us. And this is actually how to deal with praise. So remember this, because sometimes if it's your wife or your husband abuses and scolds you, now you know actually what to do. Do the four called Brahmaviharas. Give them lots of compassion if they scold you. And if they praise you, this is what you should do. come now. Okay. Then you want the best one addressed amongst us. Monks of Maharadushi is taking possession of those Brahmin householders, telling them, come now, honor, respect, revere, and venerate the virtuous monks of good character. Then perhaps when they are honored, respected, revered, and venerated by you, some change will come about in their minds, whereby the Maharadushi may find an opportunity. Come, monks, abide contemplating the foulness in the body, perceiving repulsiveness in nutriment, perceiving disenchantment with all the world, and contemplating impermanence in all formations. Now, these are all the things which give rise to a sense of just being detached from the world. As the foulness in the body is just looking upon this body as not something to delight in, but something, especially those of you who are over 50 or even under 50, but sort of you're wearing out quicker than others, you know that this body is sometimes quite troublesome to take around. And it's a sort of a difficult thing. Maybe when you're young and fit and healthy, it may look beautiful, but after a while, it just is very difficult, and it's not sort of a thing really to celebrate. Repulsiveness in nutriment, it's just the things which keep this whole system going, the fuel of life. But these things are just, well, why do I have to keep on going like this? And disenchantment with all the world, I don't know about you, but when you've been there, done that, you've gone to this place, you've seen that place, after a while you see, what's the big point of going, travelling and doing all these things? You've seen one tree, you've seen them all. And if you ever want to see the Great Wall of China, I always tell people, come and see the wall outside Bodhinyana Monastery. Walls are walls. You save a lot of money. If you want to see like a wall, if you want to see Niagara Falls or a Victoria Falls, you know, in Africa, you don't need to go and see Victoria Falls, just turn on the shower. There's water falling. What's the big difference? You want to see sort of a big mountain and climb Mount Everest, you know, just go up to Gidgegannop and climb a mountain up there. Just a mountain's a mountain. So sometimes after a while you think, just big deal. So perceive disenchantment with all the world and contemplate impermanence in all formations, especially impermanence in praise and in blame. Because you know what it's like in this world. You get praised and praised and praised, and then you get blamed and blamed and blamed. So it's always impermanent. So when you want to roll one way and people are praising you, saying what a great person you are, you know it's impermanent. It will not last. And sooner or later, people will say that's not good. Even look at me giving a talk on a Friday night. Sort of, you know, I tell a joke and think, oh, that was a wonderful joke, Ajahn Brahm. But that means I have to get another one for next week. When I tell the same one again, you know, it starts off with praise and then it gets blame again afterwards. You give a great talk one week and then people expect a great talk the next week and it's not so good, so you know, you get abused. So it's up and down. You can't win in this game. So you know that whatever you do in your life, there will be praise and people thinking you're great. There'll be other people who are thinking you're a heretic and should be thrown out. You know what it's like in this world. So we contemplate impermanence in all formations. So even praise, we don't take it personally. Yes, Dania. Okay, the nutriments. There are the four nutriments which keep people going. And it's the physical nutriment, which is just your food. I don't know about you, to contemplate repulsiveness in your food. If ever you want to lose weight, there's all these wonderful exercises for monks about perceiving nutriment in food. And one of the things, which hasn't really worked all that well, but I've tried my very best, whenever you see something, say you get your favorite food, and there it's in front of you, you know that actually, you put that in your mouth, and at the other end comes this brown stuff, you know, the shit. Now where does that shit come from? It must be in the food. It must be in there, because it can't come from anywhere else. So next time you see a plate of food, you know that in that potato, in their rice, there must be some brown stuff in there somewhere. And what the body does, it takes all the other stuff out, and then actually the brown stuff is what's left. So that brown stuff, that shit, is actually must be on your plate, you know, when you actually eat it. It's in there. It's in there somewhere. It's just, you know, you can't actually see it, because where else would it come from? So next time you have your dinner or your lunch, have a look at that and say, where is it? It's in there somewhere. Is it in that pea or in that sort of piece of pumpkin or whatever? But it's in there somewhere. And that's you lose your appetite. So anorexia. Well, that's the other side. You don't take it too far. This is actually when people get into praise and think that's so good. So that's one of the ways. See the impulsiveness in nutriment. And if that doesn't work, you know, it's just a this is for lay people. Just think about it. Just all this food. Just how much time does it take you to actually to have a meal? Especially if you cook it. Take all the time going to the shops and buying all the ingredients. And that's just what you do. All the people who actually farm those ingredients, and they plow the fields, and they sow all of that, and they reap it all, and they store it all, and they transport it, and they clean it, and they package it, and they sell it. And just how much work goes into that. And then you've got to put it together and cook it. And you get all the dirty pots and pans, and you put it on the plate there, and you know, just to be hot. And you know, your husband or wife looks at them, and they just put it in their mouth and just watching something on the TV at the same time, not even tasting it, just shoveling it in. 5 minutes, it's all finished, and then it's another hour to sort of wash up and scrub the pots and pans and tidy everything away again. Just for 5 minutes of eating. Gee, what's the point? It's just due just to a time and motion study of a meal, how much it actually takes to actually eat it, and how much in preparation and cleaning up afterwards. Gee, it's just hardly worth it. Or if you think, I'll just go to a restaurant. Just how much does it cost? How hard you have to work for your money just to get that food? So it's much better if we could just get a pill. A pill with all of the nutrients and things for the day and just put it in like slow release. So just one pill a day. It would be so efficient. You wouldn't have to have kitchens in your house. You wouldn't have to cook or go to a restaurant. Just have like a food pill. Just put it in your mouth and it's slow release throughout the whole day. All your nutrients, just the right amount. Oh, wouldn't that be good? Would it? Anyway, that's one of the nutrients. The other nutrients, if I can remember the four nutrients now, because I didn't look this up, there's a nutriment of actually contact, which is like experience. This is like sensory contact. And that's an interesting nutriment, because without that contact, sort of the consciousness, the body, just can't continue on. And I often notice this, that if a person is, say, blind, at least they've got their ears and they've got the feelings, but can you imagine if a person was, say, blind and deaf, would they be able to survive, do you think? Sorry? Helen Keller, blind and deaf, feeling, if that takes off. Sometimes if you take too many senses off, there's not enough experience, there's not enough actually to engage you with the world. You just die. So actually that contact, that experience, is important for the continuation of the body. And this is an interesting point here, because a couple of people have given me this copies of a new research which was done about people in vegetative states. This is not in coma, vegetative states. They got their eyes open, but they thought they weren't experiencing anything in this world. They weren't able to actually to communicate back to people. But some clever guys, I think in UK, were doing MRI scans, and they were asking the person to imagine either playing a tennis match or just going through a walk in the forest. And they could actually see the difference in the brain scan. If you're doing something active like or specific, like playing tennis, that lights up one part of the brain, and some spatial consciousness experience, like walking in a forest, lights up another part of the brain. So they're asking these people in vegetative states, if you say yes, if you mean yes, think about playing tennis. If you mean no, think about walking in a forest. And that way they could actually see their brain to see which part was actually they were thinking about. They could actually ask questions to these people in vegetative states, and they found out they gave actually answers. In other words, they were awake. They were being able to hear and see everything which was around them. But they couldn't communicate back to people because they couldn't use speech. They couldn't even squeeze any of their muscles. But they could still think. So it was a very brilliant experiment. People in vegetative states, they cannot move any part of their body at will, but they can still think. And by having thinking in one particular mode or another particular mode, they had a yes-no sort of device which people could actually see, and so they could actually ask people in these vegetative states, and they found out they were awake. And they could actually see and hear everything which is going on. And now they've found a way to communicate with them. If they couldn't communicate, if they didn't feel or hear, they would die. They would not be able to survive. Yes. Okay, I'll just stop there a bit because this is an interesting one. There's an animal, what's it called? Sea squid. So when it's very young, it has a brain and it has to use that to find a place to latch onto. And then after it's latched onto it, it eats its own brain. To use up too much metabolism. So it eats its own brain up. So it doesn't use it, so it eats it. That explains a lot of some of my friends. But we won't go into that. It's a very good. That's another nutriment, contact. Another nutriment is will. Basically, we all know that people who give up the will to live die. You have to want to live, have to want to keep going. And then some people just give up. And they just die. And sometimes there's not much wrong with them. So that's another of the nutriments, will. Now there's four of them. And there's contact, there's will, consciousness, gives itself. No, not consciousness, I think. I don't know, but I think there's another one. Sorry? Craving. Yeah, I think that's part of. It could be craving. Yeah, I think you're probably right there. Craving. Craving and will. Although craving and will are very close together. Wanting keeps you going. Yes, nutriment for the existence of beings who are already in existence or for the coming into existence of those waiting to be born. That's what I mean by nutriment. Four nutriments. Okay, what are the nutriments? Is consciousness the fourth, yeah. Okay. Not craving, but the consciousness. Because I think will is basically craving. Okay. Where do we get to? Oh, yeah, the foulness of the body and stuff. Oh, that's right. So that's actually how we deal with praise. Seeing it. You know, what on earth are you praising anyway? So, Evil One, when those bhikkhus had been thus addressed and instructed by the Blessed One, Kakusandasa, accomplished and fully enlightened, then gone to the forest or to the root of a tree or to empty your heart, they abided contemplating the foulness in the body, or at least just unbeautifulness, perceiving repulsiveness in nutriment, perceiving disenchantment with all the world, and contemplating impermanence in all foundations. So, in other words, they just didn't get sort of aroused by all the praise. Then when it was morning, the Blessed One Kakusanda, accomplished and fully enlightened, dressed and using his bowl and outer robe, he went into the village for alms with the Venerable Widura as his assistant, as his attendant. Then the Mara Dusi took possession of a certain boy, and picking up a stone, he struck the Venerable Widura on the head with it and cut his head. I remember once I was in Bunbury, sitting meditation there, because I used to go down to Bunbury to teach meditation at the prison there, and the only convenient public transport was the lunchtime train, the Austral End, and the only convenient time to teach in the prison was in the evening. So I always had a free afternoon. So a lot of times I would go meditating on the beach. And this was a time when, for those of you who've been here a long time, when Rajneesh was very, very well known, and he had sent his disciple, I think Sheila her name was, into West Australia, and he was threatening to have a big centre here in Western Australia. So it was on the news, and it was very sort of, most people were very upset about her language and just the way they were treating everybody. So they weren't very popular. And so when I was sitting on this beach, I'd been meditating only for about 5 or 10 minutes. I heard the kids had just come out of school, and someone shouted, "Get off our beach, Rajneeshi!" Because they didn't know that I was a Buddhist monk. They thought I was a Rajneeshis. And no, being a monk, I just carried on meditating. I said, "Get off our beach, Rajneeshi!" And the next thing I knew, like a stone whistled past my ear. They started throwing stones at me. Fortunately, they were bad shots. So after about 10 or 11 stones, I realized my luck wasn't going to hold out. So I got up. And I, instead of running away from them, you walk towards them. And when I started walking towards them, they were really spooked, and they all ran away, except one guy. And when I went up to him, I said, "What are you doing?" He said, "Yeah, we don't like Rajneeshis." "I'm not a Rajneeshi, I'm a Buddhist monk." He said, "Oh, you're a Buddhist monk. I'm sorry, you thought you were Rajneeshi." So they all came up, and I taught them a bit of Buddhism. But you see that, you know, even Mara these days, he gets possession of boys and they throw stones at you. So I had stones thrown at me here in Australia. So, you know, it does happen. But that's what happens if you get stones thrown at you. You walk towards them. That's, you know, if they're kids. If they're bikies or something, walk the other way. Okay, now where were we? Oh, yes. Mara Dusi took possession of a certain boy and picked up a stone. He struck the venerable Widura on the head with it and cut his head. With blood running from his cut head, the Venerable Widura followed closely behind the Blessed One. In other words, it's only blood. A Kakusanda accomplished and fallen enlightened, and the Blessed One, Kakusanda accomplished and fallen enlightened, turned around and looked at him with the elephant look. I'm not quite sure exactly what the elephant look is, but instead of just looking around this way, the whole body goes around. So you don't actually, it's like somebody with a sore neck. So, you know, instead of just looking around this way, the normal way of looking around, just the whole body turns around apparently. I don't know why they say that, but anyway, that's supposed to be what the elephant look is. Took around with the elephant look. Where's it gone? And said, "This Mara Dusi knows no bounds." And with that look, evil one, the Mara Dusi fell from that place and reappeared in the great hell. Now remember, this is Mahamoggallana saying, this happened to him. "Now, evil one." And remember, in all these suttas, before the time when you had horror novels or TV, you know, people loved descriptions of hell realms. That's why if you go to any of these ancient temples, even some of the modern temples, they always love having murals of hell realms. And you'd be surprised, those are the realms people look at most of the time. The heaven realms, which are also on those murals, people just look at that and just pass by. Why is it that people love looking at the hell realm pictures? Why is it they like sort of looking at these horrible movies? It's interesting. But anyway, even in the time of the Buddha, people would always, they mentioned hell, they'd always have to describe some of them in the most lurid of fashions. "Now, evil one, there are three names for the great hell. The hell of the six bases of contact. The hell of the impalement with snakes and the hell to be felt for oneself." In other places, they give different names, which actually gives the idea that these are actually just the way we create our hells. "Then, evil one, the warns of hell came out to me and said, 'Good sir.'" And I always wonder about this, because even in hell, people are just so polite. They always say, "Good sir." They don't, you know, not like in a sort of a modern jail where, you know, you crim, you worm, you worse things than that. But they were very polite in hell. I don't know if they, you know, still have that type of etiquette in these days, but certainly in those days, those wardens of hell, they were well trained. "Wardens of hell came up to me and said, 'Good sir, when stake means stake in your heart, then you will know I have been roasting in hell for 1,000 years. Now, roasting does not actually necessarily mean like being burnt. Roasting was a word, and they even got it in sort of in the Thai language, for like being tortured. It means being in pain. So it doesn't mean like roasted, like, you know, a barbecue. It just means, you know, being experiencing great pain for a long time. I've been roasting in hell for 1,000 years, for many a year, everyone, for many a century, for many a millennium, I've roasted in that great hell. For 10 millennia, I've roasted in the auxiliary of that great hell, experiencing the feeling called the emergence from ripening. My body had the same form as a human body, but my head had the form of a fish's head. Don't know what's wrong with that, but anyway. And then we get some verses. Now, whenever we have these verses, these are just, all verses are just meant to evoke a feeling. So they're just there for a little bit of ambience to the sutta. They're not meant ever to be specific. If you want specific teachings of the Buddha, precision comes in the prose versions. The verses are always there to evoke feelings rather than be precise. Just as in English verse. Remember one of the famous poems by Wordsworth, I wandered lonely as a cloud. Now that's not meant to be precise. It didn't mean one was flying through the sky at sort of 1,000 feet. It was meant to evoke a mood. Now poetry is meant to evoke moods, so you shouldn't take this word for word as if it's describing something which you have to learn. It's getting the mood. So here we go. What can hell be well compared to, wherein Dusi roasted, assailant of Vidura, the disciple, and the Brahmin Kakusanda? Stakes of steel, even 100, each one suffered separately. Can hell be well compared to, wherein Dusi roasted, assailant of Vidura, the disciple, and the Brahmin Kakusanda? Now, one thing I would put out, show you here, is the word, these can hell well be compared to. And every time, even the first time I started reading all these ancient descriptions of hell, I realized when I saw words like this, this is not actually what a hell realm is with stakes or burning oil. But this is the comparison. This is the only way that people in those days could get some idea of the sort of suffering which is possible. But remember, in these hell realms, according to Buddhism, and this made the most sense to me, these are mind-made states. You send yourself down there for however long you think you should be there. And whatever pain you feel, we tend to sort of perceive it in a symbolism or in a way, just with our experience, you know, stakes or being boiled or whatever. That's the only experience of pain which people had in those days. And so that's actually how they would visualize or try to explain to themselves what a hell would be like. But that it's not specific. It's not an idea that in hell you still got the stakes, you still got the flames and all that sort of stuff. These are mind-made realms. If anyone really has done something they're very, very ashamed of and they feel they need to be punished, this very strong idea of guilt, which most people still have, if they've done something wrong, they feel they need to be punished, they will send themselves down to a hell realm. And they will make it as they feel they should experience it. Maybe afterwards they come out and they'd say, well, no, I can't explain what hell is like, but you can compare it to. So whenever you see these descriptions, these are just comparisons to try and explain a mental suffering. And even in this life, if you've ever been in very, very deep pain or suffering, sometimes, you know, just say a simple thing. Maybe you have fallen in love and your lover has abandoned you and gone off with your best friend. So it's like a stake to the heart, somebody has said. It's like being pierced with needles. And even now we use those metaphors to try explain feelings of mental and physical pain. And it doesn't mean that someone's, you know, put a knife in your heart, but that's what it feels like. Or sometimes when you've been cheated, it's like being stabbed in the back. You haven't been stabbed in the back. There's no wound in your back. But say we use metaphors in the same way, describing a hell realm. We use metaphors describing a heaven realm. We use metaphors. So whenever we see all of these, please keep that in mind. This is not what a hell realm is supposed to be. but it's what it's like. You make it, you stay there as long as you feel you deserve. Yeah. Serious mental illness, yes. Hell can be compared to some forms of serious mental illness. But imagine that type of mental illness, especially the guilt part of mental illness. Self-punishment. So self-mutilation, which people have. I can imagine that because, you know, in this world, there's other people around to basically get you out of these situations. You meet with other people. Imagine like being like in a mental realm with no sort of physical outlet. You can stay there for long periods of time. And basically you suffer. But again, not physical pain, but mental pain. Okay, dark one. And this is Mahamoggallana talking to the Maharaja who's just come out of his bowels. You have much to suffer by assaulting such a monk. You have much to suffer by assaulting such a monk, an enlightened one's disciple who directly knows this fact. In the middle of the ocean, there are mansions, eon-lasting, sapphire-shining, fiery, gleaming, with clear, translucent luster, where iridescent sea nymphs dance in complex, intricate rhythms. Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know about that, but anyway. Dark one, you have much to suffer who directly knows this fact. I am one who, when exhorted by the enlightened one in person, shook Megara's mother's palace with his toe, the order watching. This is one of Moggallana's. In order to make sure that people don't get lost, breaking their precepts or not really understanding the nature of the world, the Buddha asked Mahamoggallana once to shake. Actually, that was when there were monks. There were monks in there, they were messing around. I think Ananda was one of them, joking. And so the Buddha said, teach those monks a lesson. So in this monastery, Buddha asked Moggallana, please, bring a sense of urgency to these monks. So just with his toe, he shook this big monastic building. And all the monks thought it was an earthquake. And when they saw it was Mahamoggallana using psychic powers, they realized instead of laughing and joking and wasting time, they all got back to meditating again. Dark one, you have much to suffer by hurting someone who directly knows his facts. He says, I am one who wielding firmly strength of supernormal powers, shook all Vajrayanta palace with his toe to incite the gods, and that was in one of the heaven realms. Dark one, you have much to suffer who directly knows his face. I am one who in that palace posed to Sakya the question, do you know then, friend, deliverance due to cravings, full destruction? Whereupon Sakya then answered truly to the question asked him. That was one of the other things which Mahamoggallana reminded Sakya, who was supposed to be a stream winner but just got lost in his pleasurable abiding, and brought Sakya back to a sense of urgency. I am one who thought of posing Brahma this question in the Sudama Hall in heaven, that's God. Is there still found in you, friend, the wrong view you once accepted? Is the radiance of heaven clearly seen by you as passing, as impermanent? Brahma then answered my question truthfully in induced sequence. There is found in me no longer, sir, the wrong view that once I held, that all the radiance of heaven I now clearly see as passing. I disclaim my prior claim that I am permanent, eternal. So, there is actually Mahamoggallana just teaching God that he is impermanent. Dark one, you have much to suffer from someone by abusing someone who directly knows this fact. I am one who by liberation has touched the peak of Mount Sinero, visited the whole of India and Pupavadeya and all the regions of the earth. Dark one, you have much to suffer by assaulting such a monk, an enlightened one's disciple who directly knows this fact. Some of these monks, they actually are using the power of their mind, just leave their body and go what people now call astral traveling. And there's one of the monks, I won't say who it is, but he was supposed to be one of these great enlightened monks in Thailand a long time ago. He died many years ago. I went to visit him twice. I remember one of our monks went to visit him, and he was asking, where do you come from? He said, I come from Australia. Australia, where's that? He said, it's down south. He said, no, south. This monk had never left the northeast of Thailand. What do you mean down south? Around sort of Hat Yai? And I said, no, much further south than that. much further south than Malaysia or Singapore and Indonesia. He said, oh, is that far south? And this monk said, yeah, if you go down further south, then you come to Antarctica. What's Antarctica? Said this monk. Because these are monks who had only done 4 years at primary school, so they didn't know much geography. He said, oh, down further south is Antarctica. There's lots of ice and penguins and stuff like that. I said, oh, that's really interesting. And so after that conversation, you know, they all went to retire for the night. And the following morning, he told his monk, he said, yeah, you're right, there is a lot of ice down there. I said, how do you know? So I went there last night. And that was a nice conversation. Now, most time, people say such things. You wouldn't believe them. That was a special monk. So, you know, having been told by one of our monks, you know, about, you know, there was Antarctica, just, you know, staying in the northeast of Thailand, he went for a visit. It's much cheaper than going on Singapore Airlines or Thai Airways or Qantas. Anyway, Dark One, you have much to suffer by assaulting such a monk, an enlightened one's disciple who directly knows this fact. Now he gets a nice little simile here. There has never been found a fire which intends, let me burn the fool. So it's not the fire's fault. But a fool who assaults a fire burns himself by his own doing. So it is with you, O Mara. By assaulting the Tathagata like a fool who plays with fire, you only burn yourself alone. So by reviling someone or hurting someone, you know, it's that person never intends, you know, to hurt you, but because you hurt them, you hurt yourself. So a fire never intends to burn somebody, but you play with fire and you burn yourself by your own doing. Like a fool who plays with fire, you only burn yourself alone. By assaulting the Tathagata, the Buddha, you generate much demerit. Evil one, do you imagine that your evil will not ripen? Doing thus, you store up bad karma, which will last long. O Edmaker Mara. Mara, shun the enlightened one. Play no more of your tricks on the monks. So the monk Moggallana chastened Mara in a Basakala thicket, whereupon the somber spirit Mara disappeared right then and there. So poor old Mara just went away with shoulders drooped. The monk had rebuked him. Forgetting in his bowels. So the next time Mara goes into your bowels, you know what to do. Say, I know you, Mara, get out, and and tell him not to play around anymore. So that's one of the suttas. The Mara Tajaniya Sutta, rebuke to Mara, has a few very interesting points and a bit about the world view of Buddhists in those days and this idea of Mara being able to try and disturb the practice of good practitioners, and someone who does this in order to try and make you upset or angry or to be proud, something to get your ego going, so you've got something to hold on to and control. And they're saying in a previous life, a previous Mara, which was Mahamoggallana, so he was a really bad guy before, but eventually became one of the Buddha's chief disciples. So in the end, it had a happy ending. So it doesn't matter. There was a person who was one of the really bad guys of a previous Buddha, but eventually became sort of a fully enlightened monk in the time of our Buddha, Mahamoggallana. So even in the realm of rebirth in samsara, we can go up to the very highest, down to the lowest, and eventually we can still become enlightened. And they're giving the advice of what to do when people praise you, when they blame you. So you can even actually assume that when people actually blame you, I just, Mara's got them. In the same way when I've told that story of the man who went to buy the eggs for his wife and the boy abused him just because he was brain damaged. If somebody abuses you, you all know that story. Yeah. If someone abuses you, just think they've hit their head that day, or just assume if your husband shouts at you, that Mara has somehow got into his bowels that day and is controlling him. So just don't take it seriously. Say with someone who praises you, again, don't take it seriously. Very good. If you get abused or in trouble, you just say, oh, that's a Buddha trying to teach me something, and then you just calm down. Very, very good. So this is just another way of dealing with abuse or with praise. And also just showing that even in those days, people would not really understand what meditation is and think it was a waste of time, and would sometimes revile and scold you by throwing stones. And lastly of all, giving an idea of the way that rebirth can happen and how we create some of these realms we get reborn into. And understanding that, accepting that, that really shows you what's going to happen to you when you pass away. You can create a heaven, you can create a hell. And you don't realize how much freedom you have to actually to create those places. So please never get into guilt. Forgive, let go, especially the pain of the past, as soon as you possibly can. You've all done things which you know you're not proud of, which you wish you'd never have done. You made mistakes, you were selfish, you hurt others. But forgive that, let that go, because if you're into self-punishment, at the end of the life, when you know, people do remember those things, if there's something inside which you haven't forgiven, you haven't reconciled, that will come up at the end of your life, and you'll feel that you need to be punished, and you'll send yourself to a hell realm or a lower realm. Making up the experiencing and describing it for yourselves in ways where you've seen or read or heard about punishments, and that's the way you'll perceive it. Purely mental, but this is the way we can actually explain it to ourselves. Or if you have a positive mind, not remembering the pain of the past, but celebrating your goodness and your kindness and your generosity, but remembering those things, you create yourself a heaven realm. And again, whatever heaven realm you create, you know, the food of heaven, if it was something like me, born in London, in my heaven, you'd have fish and chips every day with mushy peas. But you wouldn't like to come to my heaven if you don't like that type of food. But don't worry, in your heaven, Cheng, you would have the beautiful noodles, whatever you like, the best possible, or whatever. Because you will create, all it means is this is happiness, and this is how you experience it, how you feel it, how you visualize it, and that's actually how it is. So you create your heavens, you create your hells, especially after you die. You create much of that in this world, but even more so after you die. And so if you learn about meditation, you learn about how the mind works, you're really way ahead of the game when you die. And lastly, a little bit of a poem there, just giving Mara just to say, well, be careful because, you know, this is a great monk you've just assaulted, and saying some of the things which he had been doing. And last of all, just don't play with fire. The fire never is not evil, doesn't intend to hurt you. But you play with it and you hurt yourself. So don't sort of hurt other people. Other people don't intend you to get hurt, but if you hurt them, the hurt comes straight back to you. So, any other questions about that sutta? The 50th, a difficult sutta because it's not as deep and interesting as others, but nevertheless. At the back, first of all, Jacob. What about people who think they're acting virtuous, but they're actually doing evil, and the whole of the world thinks they're doing evil? A lot of times that people who think they're acting virtuously, they know it's not virtuous. But sometimes they go into this state of sort of denial. But they know it's bad, they know it's evil. I take my evidence for that perception or that insight from all the times I worked in prisons. When prisoners would come up, first of all, and say, I've done nothing wrong. And one of my famous prisoners say, I've only robbed houses, I've never robbed people. Little ways of denying the fact you've actually hurt somebody. But after a while, when you get to know them, they come up to you and say, I have robbed a person, I have raped someone, I have killed, I have hurt other people. So it's only just below the surface of people. So all the bravado, all of the denial of saying, no, I've acted virtuous, that isn't true. And they know it's not true. In the same way that each one of us, we know when we've made a mistake, we know when we've done wrong. And in history it's the same. In front of the cameras, you know, the tyrants would always say, give some justification for their tyranny, for their bombing, for their sort of torture or whatever. But they know they've done wrong. That's my observation by knowing a few tyrants in my time. Does that answer the question, sort of? There are some belief systems which encourage, are like sort of like Muslim martyrs. Yeah. To kill others, yeah. But I would actually be pretty sure that after death, where there's a much greater clarity of mind, when they see what they've done, they realize they've done a big mistake. They shouldn't have done that. Okay, anyway, Dania? Apparently, if I can remember, I haven't checked this one out, but Ajahn Bhamani is working with Ajahn Analio, Novice Analio rather, on the comparison between these suttas and the ones which are in the Chinese canon. I do believe that this is less authentic than the majority. And one of the reasons is, and one of the reasons it hasn't been read out here, because it is not as inspiring, it's not as illustrative of the practice towards enlightenment. It's not sort of, you know, the nuts and bolts of what you should do on your path to becoming free of samsara. So because of that, it wouldn't have been as important a sutta. It wouldn't have been one of the favorite ones of the monks many, many years ago. One of the reasons why we haven't read it out yet until today. So because of that, there's more likelihood that it wasn't really given as much attention, not wasn't recited as much, not as much care given into it. So you have got a good point there. But nevertheless, it's nice to read some of these extra ones out. Is that okay, Daniel? Yes? Yes. 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 Yes, so this is an adage which is common throughout the world, to play with fire. Where it comes from, where it originated, we don't know. Even again, there is the adage of the file of blind men, blind following the blind, which is also in this ancient suttas. But remember, there's a lot of cross-fertilization of these adages with all the different cultures of the world. So it's very hard to find out exactly where that simile came from, playing with fire, because even cavemen, you know, they would know that fire hurts, and they would know their kids play with fire would get burnt. So I'd imagine that is an adage which is cross-cultural. So I don't think you could say it came from, you know, Buddha, or it came from anywhere. It's just something which is unobvious. Same as the fire of blind men, or blind following the blind. I know that's also in the Christian Bible, it's also in the Buddhist ancient texts as well. Where it originated from, who knows? Is that what you meant? Okay, yes. Okay. You can open people about sometimes, especially in Chinese culture, the idea of people being possessed by spirits is very, very, very strong. But remember, this was Mara this is a very powerful spirit, and he only messes around with people who are enlightened or just to be enlightened. So if you're on that edge there, then maybe you have to be worried. But the ordinary, riffraff, the ordinary person, not to worry, Mama won't bother with you. Yeah, but I mean, if they come every week, not just this one week, and they heard all these other ones, it'd be wonderful if I changed their belief system by getting them to get into jhanas and keep five precepts and all this other stuff. But this is in the context of the whole of everything else which is, comes in these suttas. And it's very, very rare you talk about any sort of possession. But a possession, just get out of here. For those people who really know what they're doing. But it's very, very, very rare that there's ever been any real possessions. Most times, you know, because sometimes when people say they're possessed, they come and see the monks. And it's only actually, in my whole life as a monk, there's only once when I saw someone who really was possessed. Only once I saw that. But other than that, most of the time it's just people just being in a psychological mess. That's correct. Very good. Yeah, that's how he dealt with. If you want to know that story, that's in opening the door of your heart about how Ajahn Chah dealt with someone who was possessed, who said they were possessed. If you don't know the story, I'll do it very quickly. They're supposed to be possessed, screaming and lathering and saying all sorts of obscenities. And they dragged them into to Ajahn Chah's monastery. And when they came in advance, they're saying they're dragging in a crazy person who's really sort of says they're possessed. Ajahn Chah just told one of the novices, dig a hole, big hole, big hole. Another novice, boil some water, hot water, need lots of boiling water. Do it quick, now, quick. And he was really shouting at these novices. And when this person came in, screaming and laughing, they poured him into Ajahn Chah, and the person was foaming at the mouth and shouting and screaming and trying to grab at Ajahn Chah, and took, you know, these villagers are very strong, took two or three of them to hold them back. See, people are possessed, they've got a huge amount of energy. And someone was like super strong. Quick, the water, is it bold yet? Is the hole big enough yet? And these poor little novices were digging as fast as they could, and they couldn't make the water boil faster, but they were putting all the wood on there trying to boil it up. And they didn't know what they were doing it for. And then Ajahn Chah said, look, this is a bad spirit. The only thing we can do with it is put this woman in a hole, pour all the water over it. The boiling water, you've got to boil all that water and pour it all over her and then bury her. And that's the only way we'll get rid of the spirit. And as soon as he said that, the woman started to calm down. It was, yeah. So that was actually beautiful, because survival was such a powerful force inside, deep inside the mind. You know, personal survival and also the fear of pain. That was enough to get that person to get their act together very quickly. But when people have been crazy and been taken to me as if they were possessed, I've never tried that. I'm not going to try that one. And they say, go on, do it. And of course you'd never do that. Yeah. Hit the monk, yeah. Now that's a great sort of question. You know, was it acting out of his own chaitanya, or was it his own intention, or was it under the intention of Mara? Now, when you understand the nature of the will, it's not yours anyway, it's all conditioned. And so in that particular case, incredibly powerful beings like Mara can. You know, if you know, you're not enlightened, if you not sort of have a strong mindfulness, can affect your will. Have you ever known that there's that psychological phenomenon of like mob mentality? When good people, they're in a sort of a demonstration, which is peaceful, and they all suddenly get violent, or in like the crowd at a football stadium, and they go berserk, and they act like a mob. Who's controlling their intention there? It's as if the crowd is controlling your intention. It's the mob is actually changing your will. And so good people do really weird things in such situations. And now you can understand just how your intention is actually open to many, many influences. That's why that sometimes in shopping malls, the bright colours, the background music, saying bye, bye, bye. So, is it your chaitanya buying the dress when you go to the shop? I know there was a very, very funny comic skit. I forget who it was, but it was an African-American comedian who put on the voice of a woman, and she'd just come home with an expensive dress, and her husband was saying, why did you buy the dress? And she said, the devil made me buy it. And I don't know if you know that classic one, but it's a wonderful one. And he goes through all of the steps. I was passing the shop. I didn't want to buy a dress. But the devil made me look. The devil made me look. I said, I don't want to look, devil. He said, the devil made me look. The devil made me. That's very, very funny. But even in the sort of Western ideas, they have an idea that, yes, someone can influence your will. People can influence your will. So be very careful there. The influence which you allow on your will. Okay, there we go. So, finished in time for a change. That was the rebuke to Mara, a sutta which no one else has bothered to read because it's a quirky one, but hopefully I made enough of interesting comments there to give you an insight into some of the less popular suttas in the Majjhima Nikaya. So let's bow three times to Buddha and do the Arahant Samma.
Arahant Samma Sambuddho Bhagava Buddhang Bhagavantang Abhivademi. Suvakato Bhagavata Dhammo Dhammang Namasami. Supatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Sanghang Namami.